Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Subcommittee on Transportation and Economic Development. It's Wednesday, February the 19th, 2003. This time I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 5539, Public Utility Commission, and welcome Rick and Lee and
Satish.
Right.
Yep, Roy. Thank you. See, I told you. With the tap the gavel, we'll have it open.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. It's a pleasure to be here with you to talk about the public utility budget, if you'll bear with me. This is the first time I've done it on this side of the table, so it's your chance to beat up on me as I did for 10 years on the other side. I have with me today our Executive Director, Rick Willis, as well as the Chairman of the Commission, Roy Hemingway, who's in, right behind me here in the audience if you have questions. And certainly Commissioner Smith would be more than happy to come over, too, if you have some other questions about that. As we were putting this together the first time, one of the things I thought was when I left the legislature, gosh, almost a year and a half ago now, and went to the PUC, I realized how little I knew about what the PUC did as a legislator. And I thought, well, we'll start out. What I'd like to do is to help you understand a little bit better about the PUC and to sort of start out, if we can, at 30,000 feet and drop down. And I've asked our staff to put together a quick slideshow, because I thought that if you're like me, sort of the visuals help out a little bit in understanding that. So with your permission, I'd kind of like to start there. And the first question I think that pops into, at least popped into my mind, was why is there a PUC? What does it do? And I think what I would suggest to you is that you need to think about the PUC as a regulator. That's what we do. And we are the representative for the ratepayers who are customers of monopoly utilities. That's why we exist, is to try to represent them having collective power. And the things that we deal with are the elements that are fundamental to most people's lives, both at their households and their businesses. We deal with water. We deal with electricity. We deal with telephones. And we deal with natural gas. And so our mission is to ensure that these commodities are available in a safe and reliable way and at just and reasonable prices to the customers. And in doing that, we recognize that the utilities that provide these services are indeed businesses, and they have a right to a fair return as well. And we've also been nationally in Oregon as part of that national movement and experimenting with trying and making a movement into competitive markets, and we'll talk about that as we go through these slides a little bit. So, again, our primary goals are to promote competition in markets where competition is possible, underline possible, maintain the commission status as an independent body that represents the customers of these utilities in open and fair process, and to try to be a policy advisor both to the legislature and to the governor in the utility matters. And most recently, one of our strong goals has been to try to streamline and gain efficiencies in the regulatory process and be there to protect the ratepayers, but not any more than necessary to get in the utility's way. The four areas of service that we provide, I'm looking at this from the consumer side, is economic regulation of the utilities, ensuring safety and reliability of the services that were provided, being an advocate for consumers, and finally, we provide some specialized or targeted services to the disabled and the disadvantaged. Sort of walking through these just a little bit at a time, starting out with the economic regulation. Our responsibilities within that is to make sure that consumers primarily get good service at fair prices. And in doing that, we're... I lose my place here. Too much text, too poor of eyes. Happens when you go over 50.
Look around, we sympathize.
Yeah, I know. We're all there, aren't we?
It doesn't get better either. Right.
Yeah, I've noticed that.
And then memory goes, as I demonstrated.
The memory goes, yeah, too. Well, you're making me all feel comfortable this morning anyway. Our role in economic regulation is setting and enforcing the price and service rules, setting rules for competition, particularly in the phone service and electrical service areas, approving mergers and acquisitions, overseeing and approving transactions between a regulated utility and their non-regulated affiliate companies, and developing rules and policies regarding energy to try and get that cost down in the future. In terms of the, on the electrical side, we regulate three private electrical utilities that serve two-thirds of all of the customers in Oregon. That's roughly 1.2 million households and businesses in the account. The three utilities include the largest is Portland General Electric with over $2.5 billion in annual sales, Pacific Core with $1.5 billion in annual sales, and Idaho Power, which covers a small portion of Melhere County and has about 15,000 customers. To give you a flavor of some of the issues that we can get into in these things, everybody's heard about Enron and the problems in the last year. I think that's been the top energy story nationally. If you look at it from the PUC perspective, back in 97, when PGE was acquired by Enron, the role of the Public Utility Commission, of which I was not a member at that time, was to ensure that the buying owner, Enron, which, as you have to understand, Enron owns the stock, PGE is still an independent company, was to assure that PUG remained a viable entity and that the restrictions that the state of Oregon placed on them did not allow them to suck the cash out. And that indeed has been what's happened. PGE remains today financially viable company with a good credit rating, and that's important because they're purchasing half of their power on the open market, and it's important that they have a good credit rating so they can do that. Actually, the state of Oregon's procedures in that, and it's called the financial ring fencing, essentially holding it in, has been recognized nationally by the rating agencies as the way to do it. So that's one of the issues that we want to further in the Enron as that's gone along, and the way we've protected the customers is we've taken a position with the bankruptcy court that says the owners, or the ratepayers in Oregon, have a lien on those assets. So if a bankruptcy court tried to move to disperse that, we would claim for the ratepayers a good portion of that, and it would be returned to them. The result or the objective of that really was to make sure that that utility did not get split up and that it would continue. One of the questions you may have is what happens if the city of Portland or another public entity buys Enron? And the answer to that is they would go outside of regulation under the basic assumption that if the citizens and ratepayers in that case choose to own the utility themselves, that they would elect the board of directors and would handle that themselves. So they wouldn't need that protection.
If, in fact, what you said just then was going to take place, how would that affect your department?
If it went public, they are one of the largest fee payers, and we would have to make financial adjustments to our department. That would be a big chunk of work that we didn't have to do anymore.
You have any idea what that figure is?
Rick?
Rick, would you pull the mic over and give your name for the record?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, Rick Willis for the record. We have looked at that. We're still working on the numbers. There's a couple of variables, when they did it, how they did it. For example, it is possible that the PUC would continue to do some safety regulation for them. That would obviously change the income that we got and the workload that we would respond to. So there's a number of factors. I can give you a white paper on that that could break down some of those. That might help. Okay. So again, there's a variety of factors that we'd have to look at.
Rick, that's an interesting thing we just brought up, and that is with the safety regulation. Do the PUDs have? Do you supervise their safety issues?
Yes, we do.
Okay, see how. Okay.
We'll cover that a little later, but the short answer to that is yes. For every utility in the state, gas and power, we regulate on a safety basis all of that. Part of the answer to that, though, Representative, if I might, Mr. Chair, is it depends. If there's been some question, and we went through that with the Attorney General's office a little bit, there's been some discussion that if the city bought it, that they would in turn hire a private company to run it. It's unclear if they did that. It depends on how they did that, whether it would fall under the PUC's regulatory authority or not. It's a situation that's never happened before, so we're not exactly sure. We're sort of falling to the defaults In the case now, if you have a municipal power company like the Eugene Water and Electric Board, for example, that's existed since the 1920s, they run it themselves as part of the municipal government. That's real clear. But if somebody buys one and chooses to run it as a private company that just happens to be in public ownership, that's not real clear. We don't know the answer to that.
Senator Morris.
Mr. Chairman, what would protect the ratepayers from the city of Portland essentially abusing that institution and using it as a source of general fund to support non-utility services and needs within the city of Portland?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, I guess the answer is you.
But as the statutes currently stand, could the city of Portland take cash from that institution and use it for other purposes?
I believe, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I believe the answer to that is that would be within the discretion of the municipality.
Follow-up question?
Yes.
In your judgment, would that be good public policy?
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, I hate to dodge the question, but I think the way that our Constitution in Oregon is structured, that almost total discretion is given to the people through their elected municipal governments to make those kinds of decisions. If I were on a city council, as I spent a number of years on myself, I would think that was bad public policy to do that. But again, that's a discretionary matter for them. Until you change it. I mean, the legislature has the authority to set the statute, so that's really, it's really not a PUC issue. It's a legislative issue.
Representative Hansel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. For probably pushing close to 100 years, the city of Portland has been the regional water supplier for the whole Portland metro region. Certainly not for the whole region, but certainly they've provided a great deal of that service for adjoining suburbs and stuff. And the record, I think, is pretty clear that the revenue that they've raised from that has been used for support of the water bill. So although certainly there's a possibility that a different body could make different decisions, but pretty much the track record over the history of the city of Portland is in that type of a public utility provider, that they've kept those funds isolated and separate for that purpose.
Well, let me ask this question, but you just said that there is no requirement that they do that. They, in fact, since they will be delivering power to us somewhere between Newburgh and Yam Hill, I mean, what hope do we have any representation? I mean, we're basically going to be at their mercy, if I understand this. Plus, they really could charge us additional money, take the profits and put in their general fund. It would be different than the standards set up for their water distribution.
Well, Mr. Chair, the real answer is it's really unclear on some of that. As the chair, Chairman Hemingway has just reminded me, there are some provisions that the federal government through Bonneville Power and their regulation puts on in terms of what a utility that buys power from Bonneville can charge for that in terms of exorbitant cost and all of that. So there are some restrictions on the use of that. But it's just not clear. I mean, we're used to a different kind of public utility coming together that's a little smaller, you know. This is, you know, we're talking six counties in a service area, so it's a pretty big question that comes up there. I suppose the bigger question is really one of, from a ratepayer's perspective, is will municipalizing a utility lower the rates? And I think there's a big question mark on that, whether that happens or not. The real driver on that for PGE comes from the fact that what caused the rates to go up, that's what everybody's upset with.
Mm-hmm.
What caused the rates to go up, like a lot of others, is the fact that they have to buy a little over half of their power on the open market, and that's going to be the same whoever that owns them, whether it's public or private, and so they're going to be dealing with that factor of the marketplace. And the issue is working capital and all of that, and what do you pay, what did you end up paying for it? From the numbers that I've seen, it looks to me that most of the, they could buy it, but most of the savings, which predominantly come from not paying taxes, that's the predominantly savings there, and some from potentially cheaper borrowing cost. Question about how much that would be. There's differences of opinion because it's a revenue bond, mm-hmm. and you know, people assume that if you're a public agency, you're going to get cheaper borrowing. Usually that's the case, but it really gets to the purchaser of the bonds and what's the security behind that, what's the payment stream. In the case of what we're talking about in a utility, it's the same payment stream that you're talking about, pledging the income from the sales of power, so there's really not a general obligation behind it, and there's questions about at what point it would be tax exempt. So I think those are some of the issues, and I don't want to suggest that we have the answers. We haven't been asked those questions. You know, we've got the people who could probably give some professional opinion on that on staff, but that's not our role. That's a role of the citizens of Portland to decide that, and frankly the citizens of the other five counties to make that decision. Ours is more, if they're a private company, we regulate it. If it's a public, we probably don't, depending on the structure they bring together.
Senator Morrison, Representative Krieger.
Well, it would seem to me, Mr. Chair, that this should be examined critically on the part of this body to make certain that in these fairly exigent times in terms of shortage of revenues, that those areas outlying Portland proper are not being used to subsidize the general affairs of the city of Portland. I think that would be very bad public policy, and if that opportunity exists, and knowing how easy it is to reach in and pull things out if there are no constraints, it seemed to me that it would behoove us to address that issue somewhere in this body.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's certainly your prerogative. It's sort of like we have a fairly clear mission. It's not our job to stick our nose into something that we haven't been asked to stick it into. But we certainly have the capability to provide some professional judgment on that.
Sure, we do have three senators with a couple priority bills at least. So.
I'm not suggesting anything here.
Let me back up as fast as I can.
What I was wondering is, you mentioned taxes. Now, PGE now pays taxes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and it becomes a public entity, then it would no longer pay taxes?
That's correct.
And what impact is that to the budget of the city and the state? Now, do you have that figure?
I believe the number that we've looked at over the years, it's going to vary depending on the profitability, but I think it's ranged from 8 to 14 million a year in that range. I think the report that they just turned out was 15. But I thought that was the report that I think you just got a copy of that the counties commissioned, I think, said 15. But I believe from the numbers that I've looked at that that's a little high. They are one of your largest taxpayers now. Okay, moving on. Where was I? We do have a couple of the others. You talked about Enron. Our expectation in the next year is that we're probably going to be looking at, we're either going to be looking at a fairly detailed acquisition or a merger proposal, or we're going to be looking at trying to figure out what do we do if they go public. So that's going to be an issue for us. Moving ahead then, one of the performance measures, and I've structured this, I believe one of your questions is performance measures and how did this relate. One of the areas that we relate to in terms of the Oregon benchmark is benchmark 54, which speaks to the cost of housing, including utilities. You have a goal, or the state has a goal of keeping spending within 30% of the household income, spending on housing within 30%. The way we try to address that is a goal of trying to keep power affordable. And while that's a term that's it's pretty charged I can use a pun, bad pun here. Our goal is to try to keep the utilities that we regulate within and hopefully below 75% of the national utility costs. We are right at that right now. Oregon utilities roughly are at 75%, and we hope to drop that down a little bit more. The issue as we move ahead in electricity, frankly, is that we have a region that has been largely dependent on hydropower, which is as cheap as it gets. That hydropower pie is not growing, but our population and the resulting electrical loads is. The answer to that are other fuel sources, which are largely, in our case, coal, emerging as natural gas, and to some degree wind. Each of those sources are more expensive to generate electricity. So the reality is that that cost will keep moving up. We should be able to stay under the national average, but we're going to track that as a higher proportion of our costs are from the sources everybody else is getting theirs from. Our rates are going to look closer to that.
Lee, were you suggesting that we'll move above 75%?
I don't think so.
Okay.
We actually have come off of the peak from a year ago a little bit. PGE has reduced its rates back down. The business rates dropped 14%. Was that right? About in the neighborhood of 14% from the high of where they're at. And again, they are the most vulnerable because of how much power they buy on the marketplace. Now, the other side of that, when the other large one is PP&L or Pacific, and they were relatively stable. They went through the energy crisis of 2000, 2001. From prior to that, people complaining that their prices were too high to being one of the lowest priced utilities on the West Coast, and their price didn't change. And largely that's the result of the fact that they generate all their own power and at certain times generate a surplus of power and could sell it. That's really the mix there. Right now, I think you have a trend of Bonneville's rates going up, where the public utilities could actually go higher than the privates. Again, it kind of depends on the market. So that's kind of the trend that we're going through, but our goal is to try to keep it down. The other energy area that we regulate is natural gas, and Oregon has three natural gas distribution companies. They service about 600,000 homes and business accounts in the state. The largest is Northwest Natural, which has a little over $500 million a year in sales, followed by Avista Utilities, which primarily serves the southern end of the state, and they have about $80 million, and Cascade, which primarily operates on the east side of the mountains, is about $58 million. Most of these have been fairly stable over the years. Gas prices are fairly fluxing now a little bit. One big issue that we're dealing with gas is it's actually a continuation of a policy of this body in 1999 to try and get gas to Coos County. We actually have Representative Krieger's bill to try and work or to change the statutes to allow us to honor an agreement that Coos County and Northwest Natural have entered into to get it there. Coos County is building the pipeline with a small amount of lottery money and a bond that they passed down there. Sort of the pipeline gets it from the transmission line, which is owned by Williams Company in the valley about at Roseburg, and connects it to a distribution system that Northwest Natural will own in Coos County. The goal of that was an economic development goal as well as an economy goal, of getting natural gas to that port city so that they could have some industrial development as well as providing some natural gas to the homes that choose to use it down there. Two of those companies, Northwest Natural and Avista, we expect to be in for rate cases in the next year. They haven't been in a number of years. The third area that we regulate is telecommunications. It's by far the most complicated area that we regulate. It involves four large telecommunications providers. Those are Quest, Verizon, CenturyTel, and Sprint United. There are also 18 small private telephone companies, 11 cooperatives. Collectively, that group provides basic telephone service to 91% of all of the phone lines in the state. Then we also have 400 companies that are certified to be competitive providers in the state. And currently, they represent about 9% of all the switch lines in the state, so you get a sense of that. About that 400, about 150 of them are what we call competitive providers, or CLECs. You'll hear the term ILEC, CLEC. The CLECs are, and the balance of those are into the long distance business. Three of the big areas that we've been dealing with in the telephone business in the last couple of years is, one is, you may have heard in the papers about the 271 process. No one knows what that means. That's a section of federal law that says the former Bell companies, if they can meet certain standards to open their system to competitors, they have the right to get into the long-distance interstate telephone business. Quest has applied for that. They've been working on that application for the last 2 years, and that application involves 14 states. They have to apply in each state to the FCC. We've been working on that one, and we have certified that, at least from the Oregon perspective, they have met the standards to open their system to competition, that they will be granted that right sometime before summer. The advantage to Oregonian is that will induce more competition in the long-distance marketplace and should hopefully drive the prices down a little bit. That's the goal. Another area that we spend a lot of time is in defining extended area service areas, or non-toll. It's the in-state long-distance toll that people decide they would rather not pay, you know, by the minute per call. They'd rather have it as part of their bill. So the way the statute is written is that we go in and work with the customers in that area if they choose that option, and try to develop a payment amount that basically holds the companies harmless. It doesn't cost them any more, and it makes it more convenient. We're currently working with the Southern Oregon region, Jackson, Josephine, and a small piece of Southern Douglas County, at the request of the legislative delegation down there, to try and define that as a region. We currently have a region. The only region we have is in the Portland Tri-County area, and that includes about, I want to say, 19 exchanges, something like that. So this is our second experiment in that. But those are regions. We also have 1,700 individual routes that have been approved and set, where people have made that choice, elected it, and gone through it. So fairly complicated process to get there, but seems to work for the people who want it. The last big area that we've been spending some time on is establishing the Oregon Universal Service Fund. And I think the easiest way to think about that one is, this is something the legislature decided to get into in 1999 as part of Senate Bill 622. And what it is intended to do is to provide a subsidy to the phone companies to provide the same level of service in a rural area as you get in an urban area at the same cost. So the simplest way to say that is, if you live in an urban community, you're paying a little bit more so that your fellow citizens who live out in rural areas don't have to pay any more than the basic $12.83 a month or thereabouts for telephone service.
What is the total shift on that right now?
What is the what?
What is the total shift? How much is it taken from the urban area to go to the rural?
I've got that number, but it was farther back than
the report. Right, we'll wait.
Mr. Chair, our Universal Service Fund, it's a moving target, but right now we're looking at about $121 million.
Keep in mind, that's in addition to the federal money. There is also, and has been for many, many years, a federal Universal Service Charge. And it's essentially goes to the very small rural providers that are, they measure it, the Fed rules measure it on a system-wide basis, are you losing money, sort of a thing, or what does it take to equalize it. So this one is more supplemental and is directed at the larger carriers predominantly. Okay. You may be interested, but I was kind of curious about this one. Kind of curious about this myself. It was the difference in cost, and the staff gave me the exchange. It is 48 times more expensive to provide a phone in a remote rural area, and the example they gave me was Imnaha, which is in the northeastern corner of our state, than it is in downtown Portland. It could be as cheap as providing $6 a month to provide a phone next to the central switch in the city of Portland, and as high as $800 a month to provide a rural phone. And if you think about it, it's just the nature of stretching the wires and putting the remote switches in there. But we all pay the same amount for our local phone service, thereabouts.
Is there going to be a point in time where we can buy them all a cell phone? And I'm not totally facetious on that.
We would love to get the coverage.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we could do that now. It wouldn't work everywhere, but we could buy them all a cell phone now.
Put a state satellite up or something.
Well, that is, in all seriousness, that is a choice that some customers are making. That's been one of the discussion points that we've had in the Southern Oregon EAS regional discussions, where people were saying, well, I've got my hardwire phone, but if I'm sitting in Rogue River and I want to call Medford, because it's a long-distance call, I'll use my cellular phone. But it doesn't work everywhere because the towers, you know, you have the hills and all of that kind of a problem. That's just a different technology. It makes some sense. I think that my own personal feeling is, in the competitive marketplace, that's probably the biggest competitor to phone service. It'll be more there than it will be the hardwire as we move ahead. And it's clearly driving the sales patterns and marketing patterns. You're all familiar with the cell phones, where they say, well, for a certain price you can get local and long distance and so many minutes and all of this. Well, we're starting to see hardline packages where they're coming out and offering those kinds of choices for the same amount of money, or for a fixed amount we'll give you unlimited long distance calling, you know, in the evenings and so much during the business day. And that's just a different pricing strategy. It's a strong movement away from what's been a monopoly. But the reality is that, and if you remember what I said a minute ago on the hardwire business, the incumbent providers, the old precursors of the Bells, still own 91% of the market. So it's not a fast change, and the primary change has been the cell phones have been a supplemental. But if you were asking for comparisons, if you were to go to Europe, some of the developing areas, the former Soviet Union, that has been the rollout. That has been the strategy of choice for a lot of it. The downside to that one is on business applications and on broadband services or internet-based things, credit cards, the technology is, at this point, at least in this country, is not at the point where it's reliable enough for that. And frankly, the quality. You know, one of the things we talk about is reliability and quality of service. We would never accept, as a regulator, the quality that you get over a cell phone on the hardwire system. Customers would never put up with it. But it's been amazing to me they're willing to put up with it on a wireless system that they're paying probably three times as much for. Right? You explain that to me. I mean, that's just the marketplace. Marketplace at work. I don't think it will replace it. I think it's a supplemental. Let me get back to where I'm at. Okay, the performance measures on phone service. And again, we talked about ours as competition, and against to what we're looking at is, as I mentioned, we're at about 91% incumbent, or the reverse of that is 9% competitive marketplace. Our goal over the next 10 years, 2010, is to get to 22% competitors in the market, 22% of the lines through competitors, 16% by 2005. How we get there, and our job is to make sure that the playing field is as level as we can, and some of that is relates to the pricing, that competitors can come in and buy the wholesale services from the ILEC. It's got to go together. I mean, that's the, from the regulatory standpoint, it's almost a misnomer to call it deregulation, because in order to allow the market to work in a connected business like this, you need more regulation, not less. So we're sort of the, in this respect, we're the guys with the black and white striped shirts on to try and make that work better. And I'll show you when I get to it in a minute, you know, what the result of that is in terms of complaints in that. Moving on to our last area is water. Certainly, it's probably, for those areas that we regulate, the most important service. Water's the basic service of life, basic commodity of life. But we don't do it very much. There are approximately 2,000 water utilities in the state of Oregon. Most of them are municipalities or public utilities, which we do not regulate. We regulate roughly 82 private companies. It's it's frankly the hard part of the business for us, because it's the areas where you've got a small amount of people and they're generally less sophisticated providers that we're working with. And I have an example up there to give you a flavor of that. The smallest one is about 17 residential customers in a small private company in Hillsborough area, and the largest one that we regulate is Avion, which is in the Bend area. I get in trouble all the time because I tend to call them land use mistakes, or people who tried to build cities in rural areas without all the cost attached to it. And largely what happened is people have built as a way to sell, and Rick's going to kick me under the table here at any minute. Largely it's to sell lots. They put in a water system along with the roads and streets. And after the houses were all sold and you had other owners, you had a water system that no one really wanted to run. And that's kind of what we're left with. So we're left with how do you make sure that water system works for the people that are there and that they have some ability to deal with that. That's what we work with. They are the largest pain for us, and they don't pay for themselves in a regulatory sense. But for those that are there, if there wasn't somebody in between, there'd be a big problem.
Senator Dukes.
This is a get back to me later thing. Do you regulate the Burnside Water Association? However many you regulate, I don't expect you to even recognize that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dukes, don't know, but
it's
I'll find out.
Burnside. Yeah. Where's it at?
Part of it's in Burnside, part of it's in Swenson. Okay. Just checking, it's my
district.
Water district.
Is it
a district?
No, it's in a private association.
Cooperative or association?
What?
Is it a cooperative or an association?
I have never dug that far into it.
Okay.
They contracted the city of Astoria to get water.
That's fairly common, that kind of an operation. The flavors of
these... Run out of the house down the road.
You have municipalities, which are really clear to understand. You have districts, formal special districts, which have elected boards and all that, and they're government. You have cooperatives, which are really not a government agency. They're consumer-owned, but they're established under a statute of law, and they have an elected board and all that, and that's pretty clear. Then you have an associations, which are not so clear what they are and how much rights the consumers have to determine rates and service levels within that. Then you have pure private companies. That's kind of the delivery mechanism that we have. Interestingly, in the other parts of the country, private companies are becoming the predominant water deliverer. Fortunately for us, it isn't that happened in here this much. Anyway, we have 82 companies that we regulate, and we regulate them in different fashion. We regulate them all for the quality of the service, working with the health division, including health, and we regulate a smaller number of that on rates themselves. I can just give you a flavor of some of the things that are happening there, and it just struck me as odd, and if you'll bear with me. We had a small company that's in Lane County, close to where I'm at, 25 to 30 customers. And you don't think much about it. If everything's working, you don't think about it at all. You just pay the little bill and don't deal with it. Well, this company, our staff has had problems with over the years. It's just a response. And I describe these small companies as sort of like the individual that decides as a way to save, to go out and buy a couple of rental properties. And, you know, you don't think about it in a professional sense rather than, you know, you collect the monthly rent, and it becomes, you know, and it comes as a rent payment, and you spend it, and everything goes just fine until the water heater breaks down, and then you're mad at your tenant because you have to replace the water heater and you don't have any money to do it. Well, the small water companies often operate in the same way. You know, they're not putting the money aside to do the capital improvements. They're not being run purely as a business. In the case of this one that's standing out there, we had an ongoing problem with quality of water. It's usually a pressure issue. Can you get it or not, or it breaks down. The owner lived in Central Oregon. The company was in the valley, you know, sort of never the two shall meet. Well, over the years, we had gotten and said, you have to have an ability to respond to your customers if they have a problem. That's your responsibility. And he said, okay. We said, you got to get an answering machine. You got to get a service or something like that. So he said, okay, we'll do it. Everything is fixed. Fine. Well, we get a call. Pipe breaks on the weekend. There's nobody to fix it. They're calling. They can't get a hold of the owner. End result is we get it fixed. They finally pull somebody in with no authority and fix it.
But we finally get a hold of the owner and says, what happened? You know, we had this discussion. You said you'd get an answer. And we said, we did. We said, well, what's the deal? He said, you didn't tell me I had to plug it in.
Oh.
That's kind of an example. We had another one. It was a rather large company owned by a very wealthy individual in the Bend area. Very large company. And we were fighting forever trying to get the water pressure up so that, you know, you just take care of your customers. The PUC ordered them to make some improvements, which would cost them a few thousand dollars. The owner said, we don't have a few thousand dollars to make those improvements. But they did have about $10,000 a month in legal fees to fight us to tell us that we didn't have the authority to tell them that. That one we resolved by, it was totally inside the city, and suggesting to the city that maybe, you know, they were providing water. Why didn't they buy the company out and merge it into their municipal authority, which is what they ended up doing. But that's just the flavor of the kind of arrangements. So you go from, on our energy side, we're dealing with fairly large, sophisticated businesses that we can disagree with, but we can work with on a business manner. And on some of the smaller ones, you know, we try that, but it doesn't always work. That was an issue during with the Ways and Means during the last session. Ways and Means and the legislature asked us to go back and take a look at our water policies and how we deal with those companies. We created, at your suggestion, what we called the Water Issues Steering Committee, recruited for that a group of citizens that represented both the owners of utility, water utility companies, customers, had representation from the two regulatory agencies, the water division,
the drinking water program from
drinking
DCS.
Water program, and got them together and had a look at it, and we charged them with looking at three issues. Basically, one is whether we should reduce, increase, or leave unchanged our current level of water regulation, water and wastewater in some cases, how we should deal with the fees amounts. Issue being, they're not paying. The amount of fees that are paid by the water companies are not covering the cost of regulation. The third one was, you know, whether there's some efficiencies that we could gain with that. They spent about a year looking at those issues with our staff's help and came back, and essentially they're probably, from a Ways and Means perspective, their basic finding was they thought that the fees, even though they didn't generate the total cost of regulation, should not be increased, and their logic on that was they were paying the same fee rate for regulation as customers of the other utilities. It's roughly the same level of fees. Just in their case, it wasn't generated enough. And if we were to turn and try to get a full cost recovery on the cost of water regulation, it probably would push the cost of the water service to fairly exorbitant levels. I guess the other side of that one is we went back and we talked to the other utilities. How do you feel about this? Because in essence, you're subsidizing that. Or in fairness, their ratepayers are subsidizing that. And basically, when you add the cost of regulation, which is about $400,000 a biennium, into the total cost of our services, it sort of disappears in terms of material accounting standards. So they recommended that they should pay the maximum rate authorized under law and recognize that that would be enough, not enough to cover the regulation. But that's a response back to you because it was an issue last time. The other things that we dealt with was how can we make the service better, and we've proposed some legislation we can get into a bit dealing with associations and allowing customers more right if they think it makes sense to ask for closer supervision. And we provided a provision for small utilities that may not be economically regulated to come in and ask for that. Sounds odd, but the advantage to that is it allows them to come in and establish a rate base in cooperation with us and allow them to start setting aside some money to deal with the capital aspects of the program. So that's sort of there. And those two bills are House Bills 2227 and 2226. We'll talk about those. The last area in terms of service area, the next area is safety and reliability. And we talked a little bit about that. The chair asked the question about our responsibility. And for safety and reliability, our service goes across the board. I mean, we are responsible statewide on the energy safety. I wanted to show you an example of slide of why that's important. One of the things, if you're new to the legislature, if you're not, you've heard it before, is pole attachments a lot. This is what pole attachments are all about. This slide, that gentleman there, I believe, is a working on a telephone line, but you'll notice that he's standing on a, you probably can't tell this, but that's a metal ladder, and it's sitting right up next to a high voltage line. And you have cable, you have telephone, and you have electrical services all there. The idea is to separate them. You have to have certification as a electrical worker to be close to that. That's what it's all about. But our job is to make sure this doesn't happen. Other aspects of that is to try and make sure the trees stay away from the line so in a windstorm everything doesn't get shut down. That's the kind of issue we're dealing with. I thought that was, I seen that one, I thought, this is graphic. This is, actually, you wouldn't believe some of the pictures that I've seen in some of the areas. Drop lines going into a house laying right up against the rain gutter. It doesn't sound like much, but until it's raining and you happen to touch that at the right time, and you hope you have insurance. Down to the details, we cover 70,000, in terms of safety, we're responsible for 70,000 miles of power lines, 100,000 miles of natural gas pipeline. One of the things that I think people are not aware of is that we, under an arrangement or contract with the federal government, have the responsibility for safety inspections and oversight of all of the gas pipelines that go through the state of Oregon. That's a delegation of authority, and they pay for that, to us to do that. So it's a fairly significant issue. It came of more concern after 9/11 as we started looking at the responsibility and relationship with that, with the state police, our version of Homeland Security operation.
Senator Dukes?
Do you have any regulation over the EPA power lines that run through the state?
Not directly over EPA.
Okay.
That's federal.
It's the lines that transmitted the power directly to a building and such. Okay.
It's easier to knock those down than people think. I was amazed. They had an example. It's been 2 years ago over in Central Oregon where somebody got sort of wild and had fun and pulled the tower over with a pickup. But the good news is it was back in service in just a couple of days.
They do respond.
Huh?
Tip them back up.
I'm not sure that's the way they did it, but it came back. We have two goals that relate to that in terms of performance goals, and essentially they both, one's for electrical, one's for gas, and there are zero defects or zero injuries. We've done very well with that on the gas side. We haven't had one for a long time. In the last year on the electrical side, we had, I think it's approximately 4 injuries. So it's not bad.
Senator Dukes, and then Senator
Kruger. Okay, so I'm slow this morning. If you don't, who does? Does anybody regulate those
BPA?
Large transmission BPA?
BPA doesn't sell.
They self-regulate.
Yeah.
Oh, that's really
and
true.
There's some oversight from the Federal Energy Regulatory Agency, but
yeah, right.
It's really BPA.
Have they found Oregon yet? Okay.
They're a very good operator on that.
Oh, I know they are, but they have the same budget difficulties that we have.
From talking with the people who are responsible for the transmissions, they're very, very concerned about that stuff. They pay a lot of attention to that. And frankly, some of that gets to be an issue is we're overloading the transmission lines. You have what they call sag. And that gets really important. The more, and if you think about it, the more power you try to push over it, it's metal.
Mm-hmm.
You heat it up, it stretches, and it's how far down can it go before it hits something.
Yeah.
And then you have a problem.
Representative Creed.
Remember, there's controversy there in Coos County regarding the safety of the gas pipeline. You mentioned that you don't have any in Oregon any recent accidents regarding movement of gas.
That's correct.
I kind of wonder where, this is probably just a ploy they were using, that they were very, very concerned about it, but at the same time, it was going to go through farm ranch type urban, rural area, where they felt there wouldn't be any response to access to response and that type of thing.
I think most people
in the Northwest reaction to pipelines really goes back to, it's about 3-4 years ago, the explosion in Bellevue. Mm-hmm. Since that time, there has been, frankly, a whole lot of work in all those states to make sure that doesn't happen again. We have not had that in Oregon. And you would have to meet our head inspector on that, Jack Dent. If you ever haven't met Jack, I can tell you a story about when I was still in the legislature, I represented Coburg, and there was a proposed power plant there. And the reason they were proposing the site was one, the guy who wanted to do it owned it. It was right next to a BPA substation and right on top of the Williams Company's major transmission line that goes down the valley. And we had a big turnout in the school gymnasium in Coburg, and people are very understandably concerned about safety and very uproarious. And someone asked that question, and Jack walked out. You have to understand the stories about Jack. Jack is from a military accident, has a loss of one hand and a problem with the other. Jack walked out in the audience, and someone said about those gas lines and said, "Those would be my gas lines. There will be no accidents on my gas lines, and not another public concern expressed." My experience has been, wherever Jack goes, that's the reaction. And when I talk to the gas companies, they all say, "Well, there's not going to be any mistakes on Jack's gas lines." We're very concerned about that. We have actually had in Oregon, one of the programs we've gone through and have going is a replacement of a lot of the pipelines. We've actually authorized deferral to allow them to go through and replace some of the older lines and update that. And it's been going very well. Oregon is recognized nationally as being the leader of the pack in pipeline safety and doing it in a responsible fashion. That doesn't mean something couldn't happen. We have, and I don't want to confuse this, you have had gas incidents in the state in houses or businesses. In fact, you had one down there, I think. I want to separate that. What we regulate are the pipelines. You know, once they go into the house and whether they're safe there, it's less so. The companies are very vigilant about that, and they're very responsive to customer concerns in dealing with that because it's very dangerous if it's not done right. Moving off of that, the other area, that was safety. Reliability speaks to the general, the quality of the service, and we have standards that are set for all of the industries we regulate. Primarily the focus on the reliability is in the telecommunications and the electrical service, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail and you like it. We have fairly sophisticated standards of measure that deal everything from the quality of the service delivered and the responsiveness of the billing offices. We watch that on a monthly basis. In fact, there's an article in the paper today speaking to Quest in terms of their coming back up to speed. They're doing a very good job now, but certainly a few years ago that was a bone of contention on that. And we spend a lot of time talking about that to make sure that Oregon customers get what they paid for and good service. Our third area that we're dealing with then is the consumer protection, consumer advocacy area. And this is an area we have, if you're familiar with the term call center, we have a call center in our building with staff there to answer the questions and try to get immediate response to, or close to immediate response to customer problems. And spend a lot of time on that in the last year. Is this one on the slide? Yeah. In the last year, there's a number of complaints keep going up, and they're primarily on the telephone side. Our complaints rose by 36% in 2001 and an additional 6% in 2002. The result of some of that on one side is that we saved the customers a little over $1 million in undue charges in the last year dealing with some of that. And that can be, give you an example. Billing errors on telephone bills. We had an example of a Portland area business that asked for our help. They had been charged $1,800 overpayment. We got that back for them and got them an additional $200 credit for their service. Now, that's a small tip of the iceberg. There's certainly a lot more that don't get that, but it's just the nature of the competitive business. We also participated with the Department of Justice in the last year to get a consent order agreement, voluntary agreement with one of the telephone companies that, in essence, charged them $575,000 in a voluntary fine, if you will, that came in to try and improve their service.
There was one just announced today, similar thing with AT&T. Give me the next slide, though. That's graphically to give you a sense of the calls. That's been the call volume as it's increased from 19. The start of that is 1992. The end date is 2002. And about in the middle where you see it start going up, that's 1997. And that, in essence, 1996 is when the Congress passed the 1996 Telecommunication Act, which intended to broaden competitions. The good side of competition is you're supposed to get cheaper rates and better choices. The bad side of competition is you get that. You get a lot more complaints coming in, and you get a lot more opportunities to use the black and white striped shirts to try and resolve that. One of the issues that we have in front of the legislature this session is requesting your authority to participate with 36 of the other states in voluntarily implementing anti-cramming program, which essentially allows our slamming and cramming, both sides. Slamming is your long-distance bills. You get a bill and discover that you're doing business with someone other than you thought you were supposed to be doing business with at a different rate. That's called slamming. The other one, cramming, is you get your bill and you look at it after a couple of months and start to say, why is it so high? Gee, I didn't know I was buying all these services. That's cramming. And the legislation we're proposing is allows us to go in and deal with that directly on behalf of the customers. We don't have that authority now. When Congress passed the act, the idea is that the FCC would do that. Well, if you work with the FCC doesn't have the culture to deal with that. That's not how they were set up to regulate television and radio station licensees, not telephone customers. And they really don't have an ability to do that. And in fact, if you called their call center, which they have two, and I think we're still, they have like 20 people to service the nation, the first thing they do is say, which state are you from? Oh, let me refer you back to the PUC. Well, that doesn't really help in Oregon because we don't have the authority to deal with that. There's a voluntary set of rules, or there's a set of rules that the FCC has set up that states can opt into through their legislature if they choose to. So that's there. The issue with that one is really one of trying to resolve that. I mentioned a minute ago that we worked with the Department of Justice. They try to enforce through the Uniform Trade Practices Act. Now, the difference there is that the DOJ, or the Attorney General, does not have the authority to act on behalf of a citizen. They act on behalf of the state of Oregon against companies that are doing unfair trade practices. So they may, as I said, fine, but if they fine a company for a group of unfair trade practices, that money comes into your general fund, which right now might be a good thing, but it doesn't necessarily help the customer resolve their billing problem. So that's the difference of how we approach the two things. They're supporting our effort to do this, too. The one in a budgetary impact, if we're granted this, we are asking for two positions to help what we believe will be an increase in the customer concerns to do that. No new money would come out of the fees that they're already being paid. Just a factoid that you might be interested in is in 1992 at our office, we received a call from an Oregonian with a problem about every 18, 20 minutes. Today we're getting a call every 3 minutes and dealing with that. The call volume has increased in that 10-year period 373%. The other way that we measure our effectiveness in this is the number of open cases. We try to, we open a case, try to get it closed, and the volume that we've concentrated on in the last 2 years, the chart just is the number of cases that are still open at the end of the month. And as you see, we've dropped that down significantly. Good staff doing good work. All right, the last area then, last service area, is the special services that I talked about that we provide to the disabled and the disadvantaged services. They're under a program that's called the Residential Service Protection Fund. That fund is paid for by a 13-cent surcharge on your telephone bill. And there are four basic programs that fall under that. The Oregon Telephone Assistance Program, we call it ODAP, serves about 42,000 Oregonians a year, And what it is it is a program for those that are low income being less than 135% of the poverty level, certified through the DHR, through their programs on food stamps and other public assistance programs. We provide them with a basic phone service at a reduced cost. That's what that program does. It also helps the hookup charges if they can't afford that. Not cell phones, though.
Thank you. On the Oregon Telephone Assistance Program, is there a resource limit? I mean, is it just based on income, or can could under income Oregonians receive that even if they still own their home?
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, no, there is not an asset test. It is income. We just use the data from DHS for that. We don't do our own research.
Representative, essentially, we don't do the certification. DHR offices do that. And so it's essentially they're using the food stamp data or the public assistance criteria. They tell us what it's there. Then we work with the phone company to, in essence, credit their bill. But that's the way it works. We really don't want to get into the income determining business. We got a bunch of economists and engineers and accountants. The last thing we just get into that side of the business. The next one then is the telecommunications access program. This is it's a program that serves the people who are hearing impaired or speech impaired, and it provides equipment for them on loan for them to use to do that. About 3,500 Oregonians, many of them seniors, take advantage of this program on an annual basis. The third program, the Oregon Telecommunications Relay Services, similar program. It's essentially, the easiest way to envision this is you want to talk to a friend or a person who is hearing impaired, you don't have the equipment, you can call our contractor, which is Sprint, and you'll get an operator, and they will relay it. They have the equipment, typing equipment that'll display it, rings it, or turns the light on in the other person's house, and you can communicate back and forth through that individual, sort of an interpreter, if you will. We are doing some experimenting on that with some, it's called the voice carryover service that kind of will deal with that on a more automated basis. Same service, it's just a quicker service. You don't have as much delay with the person having to hear what the one person is saying or read it on coming the other way and convert it. This actually uses voice activation software. The fourth one is called the Emergency Medical Certificates Program. And this is similar to the prior one. It sets a standard basic service for people who need it for medical reasons. It's certified by a medical professional saying this person needs to be hooked up. If they can't pay for it, it keeps it in place, keeps the phone service in place. All right, this then, our performance measures in these areas, again, relate to benchmark 74, which, again, if you will, is the speaks to the cost of housing, including utilities. And our goal with this regard is we're at about 12% of eligible recipients now. We'd like to see that get up to serving at least 24% of them by 2005. Try and get a better knowledge of the program out there, increase that. Second piece of that one speaks to seniors living independently. 26% of the recipients of the TDAP program or the technical equipment are 65 years and older. Trying to increase that percentage served also.
Okay.
So that's the four service areas. One of the questions you've asked, as I understand it, all people is to sort of rank your services if you have to do it in a priority order. As we looked at ours, our sense is that the most important thing is safety of the service, safety and reliability. Second is the economic, make it affordable. Third is the consumer advocacy. And then last, not necessarily least important, but it's the specialized services that we provide to a small number of our customers. So that's how we would prioritize the services. All right, now switching to money. Where's the money come from? I think that's important. Where's it come from? Where's it go? In the case of the PUC, first thing is it's not lottery. It's not general fund money. All of the services that we get are
come from either direct utility fee for the basic service, and that's about 20 cents a month on utility bills, the cost of regulation for customers, or there the surcharges that I talked about to run those four specialized programs. We have a little bit of income, and I'll state it that way, that comes in from, we provide some services to LUBA and to some others, and we have a little slice of federal money that we get for protection of the pipelines, through the pipeline safety program. That's our limited funds, or our operating budget. The non-limited funds that don't really go through our budget, they're the sort of a direct pass-through, or the Oregon Universal Service Fund, and that's almost $122 million of biennium. Comes off the bill, goes directly to the telephone utility to subsidize those rates. Where does it go to? Functionally, we're divided into four basic areas in an operational sense. What we call policy and administration is the biggest chunk. Utility regulation is the next largest. Then the special programs that we just talked about. And third, the pipeline safety. Again, big circle, the non-limited funds is that pass-through money that goes to provide telephone subsidies. Looking at it from how the budget has grown over the years, we've grown at about 3% a year. The red chunk on top, there's the first year of the Oregon Universal Service Program was included in our limited budget. It's taken out now, it's separated. But the purple colors, I guess that's purple, lavender, relates to our growth over the biennium. And as I said, from the last year, it works out to about 3% a year inflation. Why the increase? The only cost increase in terms of staffing that we had were two positions that were added to consumer services in the last biennium. We had two FTE added to that. Then it came up. The other drivers that on the budget are primarily cost of wage increases, benefit increases, rent to DAS, and attorney general's fees and some general other things in there. But basically, they are cost drivers that are outside the direct control of the Public Utility Commission. They're sort of the DAS tells us what the fees will be or what those costs will be, and we obediently put them in our budget. So, dropping down then into how does that go? Functionally, to start out there so that you understand, we're basically split into three functional units for the operation of the PUC. Obviously, the three commissioners are the governing body. Then utility regulation, which is the nuts and bolts of energy, water, telecommunications I talked about. Consumer services, which are the programs that we just talked about in terms of protecting consumers and running these four special programs. And then our administrative hearing section. The administrative hearing section is almost an adjunct, really, of the commissioners. That's the law judges that we work with. Organizationally?
Let me catch you real quick.
I'm sorry.
You'd mentioned earlier that two FTE potentially going to be added for the...
We're added in the last biennium.
They were added. Okay, now this question is two additional or just the two that were added?
Would be... Two were added last time.
Right.
If the legislature authorizes us to get into the slamming and cramming business,
right,
we were asking
that
for two additional thing. FTE to deal with that.
Okay.
Thank you.
All
right. I think that's a policy choice in terms of do you want us to do that or not? And if you do you want us to keep those caseloads and the ability to handle that down? Keep in mind, again, that this is not new money. This is money that comes off the existing service fee that customers are currently paying. Okay, and I wanted to move to organizationally. This is where the bodies are. We have approximately 124 people that work for the PUC, and they are arranged in four general sections. The difference in the color coding, if you will, speaking to the red and the green. The red and the green are programs, and I'll get into some details, that service across the board, but for budgeting purposes last time, Ways and Means asked us, because they weren't to a specific utility, to put them in the central services fund and allocate their costs as the time goes. So budgetarily, the green goes together. Functionally, it sort of falls under the other column there a little bit. I don't know if that made any sense. I'm not sure I can completely explain that. As I said, we have 124 authorized positions, including the three commissioners, and we have two limited duration positions as well. Kind of walking through the various programs that are set there, the utility program.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. I have a question, and I know that there's an easy answer, but it's not totally
correct. I'll hope there's an easy answer.
Looking back on the previous slide, number 37, the limited funds are $31,870,000, but then the next slide down in 38 is limited funds of $35,377,000. The difference. And then not understanding what that difference might be.
Help me out, Rick.
Trying to follow where you're at.
Slide number 37. The total federal funds, non-lottery limited, $31,870,000. Then the next slide, we have limited funds of $35,377,000. I know there's an easy answer.
Oh, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Peter Moore, the 31.6 million, not using the 31 million figure.
Satish, can we move the mic over?
Thanks. The 31 million new figure, and the number you see is the 2001-2003 legislatively adopted budget. That is the budget that the legislature passed before going home last session. And the 35 million figure that you see is the budget that the agency is requesting for the coming biennium. The governor's budget for 2003-05 has $35.4 million of limited funds consisting of other funds and federal funds. So what you're comparing is the budget for this biennium versus the budget for the next biennium.
So this is the fifth special session.
If we go down to the fifth
special. 103?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, if I can add a little bit. What we add in addition to that is our ending balance. Okay. So if you take our revenue, our ending balance, and you come up with a new projection for 03-05, and that is that bottom of 35,337.
Okay. Does that make a follow-up question?
Mm-hmm. Certainly.
Then, looking at the program detail on 41, it's the $35 million is what is spent in that program detail. On slide 41.
This chart?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, that's correct. That is the $35 million is the expected expenditures mm-hmm. for next biennium to operate the PUC and through this chart. And that includes flow-through money in the RSPF fund that Commissioner Beyer talked about, the relay system, as well as the operating funds.
And the FTEs within that, I didn't add these up, but you said it was, the request is 125.5. That's
in the 120, Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, the 125.5 includes the two positions that we're requesting that's related to the legislation on slamming and cramming.
Okay. I guess it would be helpful to understand one of the things that I've been tracking through all of these presentations, Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Certainly.
Follow,
absolutely.
Is to get a sense of the cost of FTEs for these support services, you know, the administrative activities. And this one looks like it would come in about $282,000 per FTE, which would put it at the highest of any of the agencies that we've looked at, mm-hmm. and I've looked at in the other subcommittee.
Senator, how are you defining that? We'd get you an answer to that.
Well, if it's a simple division, if you take the $35 million plus the Fed funds, divide that by the FTEs of 125.5, if most of my calculator was wrong last night, that is a total of, and these are just very general figures, but it kind of puts the things in a ballpark in cost of administration. And so if you could help us understand what...
Mr. Chair, Senator Morris, one of the things that's going on is we have about $10 million in the RSPF program that is money that is passed through for that relay system that Commissioner Beyer talked about. That's contract money. There are a total of five people in that program, but $10 million going through it, and that's contract money that is passed through. It comes in that 13-cent surcharge and is passed through.
Okay.
So that isn't... The piece for staff is very, very small. The rest of the money goes out, is passed through to the contractor.
Okay. It would still put the agency at a very, very high cost per FTE, the highest of any that we've seen so far. So I would just raise that as a question mark.
I'm not sure what you're trying to get to.
What I'm trying to get to is an understanding of what it costs to run these various commissions that are coming before us. And one of the figures it seems to be just as a very general, and I know that each activity is a little bit different, but if you're looking at the cost per FTE for support services and administration, what is that cost? And this, it would put this agency at the very highest of any that we've seen so far. So I just raise that as a question as to, you know, why that might be.
Rick, can we, as soon as we finish up here, maybe ask that question and see if we can clarify it?
And
we'll get an answer one of the other meetings.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Okay. Senator, yeah, I think if we sat down and went through the numbers, maybe we can help understand them a little bit better and see what's going on. But we should, as you suggest, do that outside of this.
Because I think literally you're going to have to move some of those dollars out of there so that you actually have the dollars that would be, in a sense, the cost of the FTE. Senator Dukes?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I assume your ending balance is included in there and other programs that may be transferred out or may have a reserve amount. Those kinds of things are all figured in. It's kind of dangerous to just take the total budget and divide it by the total number of FTE without understanding all the programs. And
Mr. Chair, Sundus, I think that's exactly right. There are some other things going on. Again, some money that just goes directly to a contractor that isn't directly related to the number of FTE. Mm-hmm. And I think if we sat down and spent a few minutes, we could probably work through that.
Yeah, I think that revenue flow chart would be a really good thing to see. Okay. Thank you.
What was that?
42.
I guess we're just going back in the utility. The utility section is sort of the core section of the of the agency, and that's essentially where we have the staff that goes through and analyzes, works with utilities, analyzes their proposals, formally testifies in front of the commission, makes that case, if you will. It's our group of analysts that deal with that. They're split into, they're split into three basic areas: electric, natural gas, and telephone, and dividing on down. And it's in each of these cases, I'm the risk of being a little redundant here. I'm trying to cut my slides a little shorter here. This is actually down to the nuts and bolts of the people who put the cases together and work with the companies and analyze the rate cases and so forth. Go forward with that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. Let me begin by saying I sure appreciate the work you folks are doing. I appreciate you coming and visiting with us and talking about these issues. Under the responsibilities, one of the issues I'm hearing from folks back home who are in the utility business and also folks over on this side of the state is there's some concern over the accelerated safety inspection program and trying to distinguish between those safety issues that are paramount versus those that are really more minor and perhaps not safety oriented, and the schedules that are being required of these utilities to address all issues, and the cost concerns that these utilities are having, trying to work their schedules around to manage this. And I guess it's one. My question is perhaps I could get some more information on how the safety inspection program works, and two, how, what steps are being taken to make sure that it's user friendly for the utilities. Not compromising safety, but at the same time allowing a little bit of common sense to be used, so those issues that are most concerning are dealt with, while those that are minor infractions, we're allowing the utilities a little bit of flexibility to take care of those. So I guess there's a question in there along with a statement, but perhaps either now or in another meeting, we could talk about that issue, because that is a concern of mine.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it'd be helpful to have details on that. I think I know what you're talking about. I think what you're speaking to is the, where you represent is a lot of people that are co-ops and PUDs in that area. They tend to be speaking towards the safety program. A lot of it's tree trimming around the wires, and that's it. And I don't know if it's accelerated. It's as you move around. If it happens to be your turn in the box to be inspected, you may feel like it's an accelerated program. My own area where I live in Springfield kind of went through that, and I'll tell you, they weren't real happy. It was during the middle of the 2000-2001 when the rate hikes were going up. The last thing those utilities wanted to hear is to have our staff come in and say the trees are too close to the lines, you got to get them cut down, or in a windstorm you're going to lose power, you're going to endanger somebody's life. And that costs money to do that. It wouldn't cost as much if had they been doing it all along, but that's just the nature of things, you know. That when we went into that, and we did have a windstorm in my area last spring, I think it was, and I seen firsthand the effect of that. The particular utility that I get service from, and frankly bellyached a lot about doing it, had no outages.
I think
the utility next door was down. Some of the services were down for a week.
Let me clarify that, Madam Chair. I think the concern is trying to distinguish code violations and allowing the utilities a little more greater flexibility, because out where we are, we cover thousands of miles, and not every code violation, and again, I'm not an expert in this, but this is what I'm told, not every code violation requires immediate addressing, because there, while it perhaps is a violation, there's not an immediate threat to public safety, while there are other issues that are. And I think what I'm hearing is that every issue is almost being treated the same, that if there's a code violation, it will be dealt with immediately. And the flexibility to the utilities is being limited. And so I guess I would hope you'd have a little sensitivity on that as you're working through this. And I'd also be more interested in just hearing a little more about how the program works as well.
And if we're not, we need to be. Sort of our bottom line, or at least my bottom line, with the staff is, frankly, if there's something that's endangering the public, there is no discretion.
That's right.
Get it fixed.
Right.
If it's something you can take care of, then we ought to be reasonable and work with people to do that. And I'm interested in knowing more about that, because I know the one that I worked on, which, again, because I live in Lane County, it had to do with that. Our staff were very reasonable when they said, I'm going to work through it and gave some time. But if we're not doing that, we need to know about that. Where was I? Just trying to get back. You're going to find the similarities in each of these slides is going to walk through gas, electric, and rather than waste a lot of your time, I'm going to tell you that the responsibilities for the staff, and they are divided up into the different areas, are to deal with the same things. It's to deal with the pricing structures. It's to dealing with mergers and acquisitions, contracts with affiliates, and so forth. Largely what you're going to find in each of these units are people that are very technically trained. They're either economists that are dealing with forecasting power or rates to deal with that, working with the other states. The utility comes in and they got a forecast. We got to have somebody who understands that and can deal with that. We've got 10 or 12 PhD economists on the staff to working with some of that. Some of them are in management positions, but the idea of management versus the others is a little grayer in ours because everybody is a working person. Other than the three division heads, we don't have any peer managers that aren't carrying a regular workload, too. In telephones, you're going to find a lot of engineers, and you're also going to find accountants to go out and audit the books and deal with that. So that's kind of the spread of duties that you're going to find there. But unless you would like, I don't want to go into great detail on those. Kind of dealt with that competition. The uniqueness of telecommunication, as we said, is that we're trying to, as both a national and state policy, promote more competition. That created something a little different. Rather than just regulating rates, it's also the matter of going in and making sure that the system is open so that competitors have a playing field that they can play in. So we're finding we have to spend more time dealing with that and making sure the charges. A lot of the competitors, and it's the nature of, it's like sticking a plug into a wall. Those things have to work together in order for telecommunications to work. In some cases, in fact, in most cases, competitors not only have their own equipment, but they also buy at wholesale services from the existing carrier that's there, and making sure that those, what the statute says, 622 said that, and those pricing, the prices have to be wholesale, and they have to be, they have to have both a cap and a floor on them so that they don't drop the price so far that it discourages competition. So, again, it's sort of the black and white striped shirt position that we're into in dealing with that. And there's a whole lot of disagreement about that. Huff goes through there, so we spend a lot of time. Sandy, I think I jumped a bunch of slides on that. We've talked a lot about the universal service from an extended area deal, so I'm not going to be real redundant here. I don't want to waste your time. Get to some of your questions. The one area that I talked about was in that box, if you'll recall, was the red ones that I said were the green part of that. The financial analysis unit, speaking of a lot of that, when you're doing rate regulation and you're trying to project cost and you're trying to analyze it, it doesn't make sense to have one team set up in electrical area, another one in gas, and another one in telecom because of the nature of the rate cases. What we have is this unit that covers all of that, and they're part of the team. When we're doing the rate case, we pull people together, and they do it. One of the things that you may not understand is these people, when they're working at it, as a commissioner, I can't talk to them. Mm-hmm. Because we set as a quasi-judicial body, so they actually become a participant in the case. They come in, and their job is to analyze it, and their job is to put the case on the record for us to decide upon. The statutes say that we have to decide based on the evidence that's introduced into the record. So they are the antagonist to the company's proposal. It's the company's responsibility to prove that they need what they want. It's our staff's responsibility to analyze it and put on the record what they think is there. And then we have what we call intervening parties, which are others that come in. They're usually like the industrial customers of the Northwest that will argue that any rate increase is not fair. And that's sort of their position, so that we have the full record on which to make a decision, or other groups. So that's kind of the split of how we are set up here. And it makes a lot of sense from a business perspective. It makes it a little harder to put it in a functional chart where, you know, is this a dedicated service that belongs in electrical or whatever? Mm-hmm. No, not really. And it's going to vary from time to time because we don't have any control over what cases come to us. We sort of deal the hands that are dealt to us. And so it's going to vary. We're guessing what's going to happen when we're standing in front of you over the next 2 years. And in fact, if you'd asked me last fall what was going to come up, I'd say, well, we got this PGE case, but I'm not sure on the others, and now we know that we have at least two gas rate cases that we'll be dealing with in the next 2 years. We know that we'll probably have something in the merger sense with PGE. We know that Pacific Corps is going to come in for a case, and we know that there are a couple other things that might happen that are out there. So you're never really sure, and nobody knows what's going to happen in the power markets next year and whether what that's going to cause. So that's very inarticulate, but it's trying to explain our response.
Just a general question. Are we seeing the Canadians trying to push up the charges? Is that a major component here?
I'm not aware of any. I think you're speaking to the electrical. I'm not aware of any of that. The Canadians, in terms of the electrical, they're part of the Bonneville system, and we have a national treaty in relation to that. The gas prices.
I can remember being at Boardman, and the gas was coming in from Canadian supplier.
I don't think we've seen that, Senator George. The thing that's been different in the natural gas side is last year, maybe 2 years ago now, the Canadians, they completed a sort of a Trans-Canada pipeline that was able to take the gas out of the western provinces and drop it down into the Chicago marketplace.
Right.
That made our market more volatile. It made it starting to look more like the East Coast market. It wasn't greatly to our advantage, but I don't think we've seen anything that suggests they're taking advantage of that.
No, I wasn't suggesting. I was just asking if you were seeing any, you know, trends moving that direction, because you know you always assume with so many power generating plants, you know, coming online as gas, that pretty soon you reach a point where the demand for the gas is going to push prices up. I didn't know if that had occurred or
that issue we think is there very much so. Almost all of the new resources that are coming in line are natural gas-fired plants. Quite a bit of wind, but predominantly natural gas, and that will, over time, push prices up. And not just, I think most people think about that in terms of pushing up electricity prices, but the reality of that is that's the same commodity that many of our industries want to use.
That's exactly what I was thinking about. Thank you.
I mean, it raises an interesting, I think, policy question for the legislature in terms of where we should be. Personally, I've always wondered why we didn't have a policy of encouraging people for space heating and water heating to switch to natural gas, even with the issue you're bringing up, because if you look at the efficiency of the use of that resource, most of the water heaters and the space heaters are 97-98% efficient in use of that BTU for that. If you look at using that same BTU for electricity, the best of the combined cycles is about 43-40% efficient. Mm-hmm. Then you've got the line loss of power when you try to transmit it from Boardman someplace else. It's a very interesting energy policy question that I frankly have seen very little interest in our state to deal with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've heard rumors that because of the harsh winter on the East Coast, that they've used a lot of gas reserves and they're going to have a real problem in terms of a spike of prices when they have to start recharging those reserves. Have you heard any?
We're drawing them down pretty fast, but we were pretty high. And one of the issues that we were dealing with on nationally on the West Coast is we had a lot of fairly expensive gas in reserve. And gas prices last summer, for example, were about $1.5 million BTU. That's the measuring unit. And it stayed fairly low. It's up now on the West Coast about $5. But if you looked at last week's, the last time I looked, in New York, it was over $10. It sort of depends on who you are. If you're sitting there and you happen to have a lot of that gas sitting in the ground that was more expensive than what you could sell it for, the market looks pretty great right now. You kind of want to get it out of the ground and resell it to somebody. But it's from the person on our staff who does all this, it looks like a pretty normal pattern so far. I think the bottom line is gas is going to be more expensive. I was talking with CEO of Pacific yesterday, and their forecast is it's going to get more expensive. But that's less resulting from the current cold wave. Not that that couldn't cause a problem. That is, it's just general. A lot of that, it's gas prices, and I'm far from anywhere close to an expert on this, but from what little I've gleaned over the last year, a lot of that has to do with what's happening with petroleum market in general just prices in general. It's literally how many pumps, how many wells are pumping the stuff out of the ground. And it's an efficiency factor. As the prices go up, there's a whole lot more resources that make sense to bring out of the ground. And when it's real cheap, it makes no sense. And you get the number of drilling rigs that kind of go off and on. I'm not sure if that answers your question. I think the short answer is it's going to get more expensive short term, certainly more expensive now. Long term, you don't know.
Thank you, Chair George. One of the major issues facing the utility industry is potential sale or acquisition of Portland General Electric.
A little earlier.
I apologize.
That's fine.
I have numerous questions I do want to ask on that, and just as kind of a heads up to the chair, I'm going to hold most of those till tomorrow, if that's okay, in all fairness to all the other parties that may want to listen. But I do have one question. What would be the impact on, and you probably addressed this earlier, I apologize for not being here, what's the impact on the PUC if Portland General Electric was sold to a public entity? What would that impact have on your fee assessment income?
Again, Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, we did sort of get into that earlier. The answer is going to be it depends. If they're sold to a municipal operation and the municipality operates it itself, we believe that means that they're outside of PUC regulation. It would make no sense for the PUC to represent the ratepayers if those same ratepayers had the ability to elect the people operating the utility. Then they could do that directly. Financially, what that would mean for us is it would be a significant reduction in fees. They are our largest fee source. And you could assume that that would mean a significant restructuring in the PUC. But what that would be, I don't know.
Okay.
But that's our anticipation.
Help me out here. When you gave us the numbers, you know, talking about the $2.5 billion sales from Portland General Electric, Pacific Quarter 1.5, you know, you kind of look at that and think, well, I don't know what these other numbers are, but I would guess it's 50%. Is it going to be that high? It's not that high. Okay.
Mr. Chair, those percentages are for our electric companies.
Right.
We have to factor in telecommunications companies, water, and so it's probably under a quarter of our total. But again, as Commissioner Beyer mentioned, it depends just how it's structured. If we still have a piece, if we still have the safety piece, then we would have more income and we would have more workload.
Thank you, Chair George. I think this is such a significant issue for this body. That perhaps not now, but in the near future, I could get some information on what does significant mean. What are those scenarios, and what's that mean to us as a body in this building?
We'd be happy to provide those, Mr. Chair and Representative. But I think, and I want to be real clear, our expectation would be if the citizens of the PGE territory made that choice, that would mean that was a significant piece of workload that no longer was there for the PUC, and we would change the operation, and we would go, we don't get any money except from the customers to represent them on their behalf, and if that money's not there, we have to change. We have to find a different way to do business, and we would do that.
Thank you.
Well, we can get you.
Yeah, I just think it's such
a
worthwhile issue to discuss.
I can get you some reasonable estimates, but you know they're not going to be better than that because there are so many unknowns around that. Representative, one of the things that we were talking about a little earlier is that it depends on how they're structured. If it's contract, if they were to buy it and contract with a private company, there's some questions about whether the PUC would still have a regulatory role or not. You know, that's not really clear. You know, we've asked those questions a little bit, but frankly, we have chosen not to spend a lot of money in buying AG's time to try to go through all of that because we don't know that that'll come about, and we know that if it does, we'll have some time to adjust to that, and we will. I mean, that's just reality. I mean, we'll do that. So, but we'll try to get you a better financial number on it. Okay. Where was I?
We're leading you astray.
I think I'm starting to say that we're into our regulatory or our central, what we kind of refer to as our consumer and central services, is the housing place for a lot of the services that are central business services, and it also is where consumer protection services are at. That includes the commission office, the administrative hearings, which are essentially, it's a fairly small, so we have we probably have the most highly trained administrative law judges in the state, and there's a reason for that. The utility law goes back a little over 100 years, and it's fairly specific, and it's fairly bound by both federal and state practices, and frankly, we end up in court a lot, and our opinions pretty much look like court opinions. Our things go right. If there's an appeal, it goes usually always ends up at the Supreme Court or in federal court. So it's a fairly sophisticated body to make sure that our opinions, when we issue them and our orders, are legally sound. That's essentially the deal there. I don't know that I need to say anything more about that. The consumer protection and services, we've talked about that. I'm not going to spend a lot more time on that. Our business unit is the standard. And we have a small personnel section. We have a small couple people. And we have the standard accounting section to deal with that. We talked about the funds before. Personnel, again, our personnel, it's a standard section. It's a couple of people. What it amounts to deal with our staff. Overall, some of the general questions, our administrative costs are a little under 13% of the operating budget. Cost containment, you asked us to talk a little bit about what we tried to do there. Actually, we've done some interesting things here, I think. Probably in our cost containment, the two most interesting things that we've tried to do is use more automation. We've had a program that's been sort of a migration for a couple of years to try to get more of our business on the internet, if you will, and on our web page. And we've done that in a couple of ways. One is to allow more of the direct complaints that customers file. They can do it 24 hours a day, file it on that, and we get back to them immediately. We're not open 24 hours a day, but I think that makes it easier for customers to do that. We put almost all of our orders and information goes on the web site, so they're immediately available, and that's important. The group that we work with, it's largely a court-like operation, and what we're moving to, like the courts are in general, is to try to go to full electronic filing. That has a number of positive aspects for us in terms of cost savings as well for us and for them. Rather than having to file paper, they can file it that way. The advantage to that is if they file a brief electronically, not only is that something we don't have to make copies of and distribute it there. Anybody can get access to it. And the other parties can get access to it immediately also. I think that's important. We're trying to go to that.
If you could, we've had a lot of the things that we're going to see and have seen have just an amazing amount of money that's actually dedicated to bringing that tech level up. Could you guys kind of give us a readout as to what you had to spend to get this system to the level it is?
Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay. I think that would be just a great comparison.
I'd be happy to do that. On the other side, on the telephone side, I spoke to it a little bit. We're sort of working with a couple of technologies, one of which now the program that I talked about through the translator that we contract with Sprint now for the hearing impaired, where we sort of go through an operator who listens to the person speaking and types it out and reads the reply back and then speaks it into the phone. We've moved to an automated system to try and expedite that a little bit, a voice-activated system, just experimenting with that. That's interesting. The other one is we've got something called a CapTel, which is a system that allows people to do this without having the special equipment as well. I'm not going to be very technically proficient at explaining that, but we're trying to adapt those new technologies that allow us to provide more services, higher quality services at cheaper cost where we can. And the one biggest piece on that, as I said, is the web page. It's going to take us a couple of years. One of the issues, in fact, that came up in a budget note the last time was we started out trying to image. The original idea was that we were going to scan in a lot of the pages. We sort of decided not to do that and are just sort of moving forward with as we move into the filings. And again, I think our efforts probably parallel what the courts are trying to do. Interesting to me, hopefully to you, one of the things that we found, and we have to do a lot of work with the Federal Communications Agency, FCC, and with the Federal Energy Regulatory Body. Well, the old way used to be that you you wrote out your comments and you mailed them off and standard kind of process. That doesn't happen anymore. You literally, it's a waste of time to send a piece of paper to Washington, D.C., because it could be, you know, next year before anybody reads it. The preference of style now is they all want it electronic. They all want you to send it in over the Internet in response, and that's been an interesting change of doing that. The other things that we've moved to with the groups that we have to work with, whether it's regional, you know, on electricity, the Western Interconnect, we're really talking about the 12 Western states are all connected together, and we try to make sure that the 12 state policies and the utilities operate work together on that, so it takes a lot of communications. We have moved to doing most of that business through teleconferencing rather than meetings. Still have some meetings, but we're trying to do most of that way, and the same is true of trying to impact the national policy, both electrical and telephone. We've been very involved in that, so I think there's some interesting things in trying to do more of that, work that way. And again, as I think we're in the same battle that everybody else is, how do you do more with the same or less money? We're trying to do that. So we're working in those areas. I'd be happy to share more on the telecommunications if you're interested in that.
Lee, on the TDY, the hearing impaired program, is there been a decline in its usage?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dukes, on that relay system using those TTYs, yes, there has been. There's been a slight decline. It peaked out 3-4 years ago and has been coming down since. And we suspect that's mostly due to technology, okay, Internet, that sort of thing. Yes. Yeah, we are starting to see the slope come down.
Okay. If I remember the discussions we've had about the need for a service is not going down. And the technology is making it more available to people.
Yeah, no, but I assume that when people are away from home, when they're in other kinds of situations, they don't necessarily have access. And there may be some people who don't have a computer at home. They can access it during the day at a public library. But if they need to make a call at night, used to not be there. So I was curious if overall service was down.
I mean, the sort of the general areas of things we're talking about. what is that? I'm to the affirmative action slide. One of the questions, she went behind me, on the affirmative action question, how are we doing there? We're actually fairly proud of that as an agency. We're at parity. I think you'll see in the slide in there. The numbers look very good. Importantly, I think beyond that, our staff, I'm very interested, have formed what they call a diversity council, and they have been very active. Lunchtime brown bag things of bringing in people and talking about this, having events to increase the awareness of, you know, cultural differences and what can do that. Very exciting, I think, what we've done there. We're very proud of the fact that in our affirmative action that we've received governor's office recognition the last couple of years in terms of our performance in that area. Budget notes. We had 6 from the last session. The first 2 were very similar. The one requested that we make an interim report to the e-board on our cost distribution in the areas. We did that, so we fulfilled that budget note. The second one was to do a follow-up report to that to this assembly, and we're submitting that report today to you, although it is obviously, since it's not the end of the biennium, it's 18 months plus a forecast for the rest of the year. The third budget note that we had put in, and I, as I recall, we're asking for the same things. We asked for a pot of money to be set aside for what's called special masters, and essentially that is if you get into a complicated case where you need to contract something out, the right to do that. That actually was brought up by the industry last time recommending that we have that so we had access to the special masters. We did not use that money in the current biennium. It's possible, I'm not sure if we will depends on how the rate case comes in. It's unlikely, but it makes sense to have that money available again the next time. Again, we're not going to use it unless there's a need to use it. Third area is sort of what we were just talking about, the discussion over technology. We had some imaging processes we had in mind with respect to what we call our BizApps programs, our basic business program. You asked us to take a look at that. We did and chose not to move forward with that. The fourth or fifth budget note had to do with migration of the web server for the PUC to DAS. That's an issue I think you applied to everybody. We are working. We're an active part. Our staff who runs that system is active in the DAS process, and we're working with that process to figure out where it makes the most sense to do that. Obviously, our interest is having the service available as cheaply as we can, and whether that makes sense to be on a DAS server someplace or our own, that's a technical question.
You weren't bound to still with DAS. In other words, if you could demonstrate that you could do it more efficiently, you were able to keep it in-house?
I think we're bound to work with DAS. I mean, they're responsible for that stuff, and I think that policy makes sense. My staff has some, I think like all the information, some guarded protections around that, but we're working with that, and we're going to be consistent with state policy.
The reason I say that, we were a little concerned yesterday when we had a public hearing in which folks said that one of the websites that was inside of DAS was really obsolete and almost impossible to use, and I thought, whoa, want to make sure that we can monitor that.
Well, I've made some comments about Oregon Online, but I don't want to go there. Our system, I think, the personal opinion, I think websites are a wonderful thing for people to get in and get access. And I think you need to have one that goes in there. Whether you need to have the computer in this building or another building probably is less important. It goes together. What you need is cheap service, however you do that.
Mm-hmm.
The customer group that primarily use the PUC's web system are really not the general public. I mean, there's a piece of it that comes in for consumer complaints and all that, but most of the system that we're having put together are really more of a judicial basis. It's the attorneys and the people, the utilities that are working with that.
Mm-hmm.
And to that extent, it's very analogous to what the courts are doing. Whether you need to have that in the same place that you have the DMV records or the unemployment records, I'm not sure. I think that's a technical question. I think they need to be linked. There needs to be a kind of a common sort of portal that people can get in. If they want to find the PUC, if a customer wants to find the PUC and find out some information piece, they need to be able to get there easily. How you get there is really a technical issue. Probably not one that you and I are going to solve. At least I hope not, because we probably won't come up with the right idea.
We do watch the flags along the road, though.
The last budget note we had to do with out-of-state travel. The legislature limited us to $270,000 of out-of-state travel. We haven't spent that much. We spent about $149,000, and that's kind of where we're at. We're not doing much of that, not much. Like I said, just not a whole lot of travel. You need to understand that there is a need for us to do some of that, and it primarily has to do with our need to participate in the FCC and the FERC issues to protect Oregon and represent Oregon in those forums, and also in relationship to the other states in the Western Interconnect on coordinating that on that side and on the telephone side, Quest, which is our largest telephone provider, is a 14-state region, and trying to make that system work well together. We've got a good process to doing that, and so there is some that's associated with that. What else do I have here? We have five policy packages that you'll be hearing about. Two of them, the package 101 and 102, really relate to reclassing current workers that are, we've been working with DAS and are working out of class now. We have one in our administrative law judge position. Currently we have had for a number of years sort of one FTE split, two half times hiring retired attorneys that have been doing cases for us to handle some flux. Our chief law judge is asking that we change that practice and put a permanent law judge in place. Some of that has to relate to as we're trying to do transition planning. A lot of our staff are getting fairly into close retirement, and we're trying to make sure that we don't lose the knowledge base, bring some people online. I know you folks have been dealing with that a lot with all the PERS discussions. We had some of that problem. I think we were, Chairman Hemingway found me looking one time, there were something like 25 members that are...
20% of the agency is capable of retiring now.
So that would be... We would not like to see that happen. That would be a little bit of a problem for us. And the last piece that we're talking about is the slamming and cramming piece, and I think we kind of went through that. There's a policy package. If the legislature decides that you want us to do that, we're asking for the ability, the staffing to do that. Budget-related legislation really speaks to the last one. We have two bills dealing with cramming, two bills dealing with slamming. I sort of refer to them as slamming, you know, high grade and slamming light, or cramming, same thing. And essentially, the difference between the two bills, one on each side, is one of them does not allow us to impose fines, and that's slamming light or cramming light, and the other one allows us to impose fines. Personally, I think that we need the fining authority, which is absolutely nothing, not a problem at all. If everybody's living within the law, there is no fining. But we've agreed to disagree with the industries on that. So I will. That is your judgment call. And Mr. Chair, that's the end of our formal presentation, and we'd be happy to answer any questions that you have today or gather any additional information that you would like from us.
Before we go to Representative Smith, I'll ask everyone, if you have any questions, if you could do good writing for Cindy, we'll get it then to you, Lee, and to Roy, and to Rick. So if anyone has anything, we'll do that. And then to Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair George. I just want to commend you, Commissioner and Director, for your work. I had the pleasure, I guess, 2 years ago of looking at this budget, and it was a much different environment as we were looking at this, and I really do commend you folks. So.
Thank you for that comment. But really, I have been very impressed with the quality of the staff at the PUC. They're a great trained bunch of people. They tend to all be techies, but they really know their business, and they really have the best interest of the ratepayers that we represent in mind. And I think they do a good job. Even though we catch some arrows sometimes, customers were not real happy with the prices as they went up the last time.
Okay, well, any further questions? If not, for the record, Senator Carter was excused today, and I didn't get that in earlier. I'd like to be at this time, and with a tap of the gavel, and then close the public hearing on House Bill 5539, and we will be adjourned till tomorrow. Okay.